welcome to episode 10 of the Anarchist Book Club with Jim Yeoman and me, Danny Evans. For this edition, we were delighted to be joined by Frank Jakob, whose book, Emma Goldman and the Russian Revolution, From Admiration to Frustration, will be out at the end of the year on open access, available from De Gruyter. Now, for this recording, we had some difficulties with our usual podcast platform, and so we had to improvise, and as a consequence, the sound quality isn't to the tip-top standard that you've come to expect from us. Normal service will hopefully be resumed for our next edition. In the meantime, really hope you enjoy this programme.
Welcome to the podcast, Frank. Thanks very much for joining us to talk about your soon-to-be-published work on Emma Goldman. We thought we'd start by asking why it is you became interested in Emma Goldman and why this particular focus on her experiences in regards to the Russian Revolution as the focus of this work.
Yeah, first of all, I would like to thank you for the possibility to talk to you about that book. It's a pleasure. And I checked who was talking with you in the past, so I'm part of a very extraordinary group of people that are interviewed, so I feel very honored about that. And yeah, I reached Goldman rather unexpectedly through some accidents. The first one was that I was working on, or I'm still working on, Kurt Eisner, who was the first Bavarian prime minister after the First World War, a socialist in the Independent Social Democratic Party of Germany after their split in 1917. And he had written an article about Goldman in the 1890s, where he talked about Goldman in the United States. And me coming from a classical German history education, which means Germany and Central Europe, and that's mostly it, was not aware about the history of Goldman at that time. So that was like 5 years before. And then I started to read some of the books about Goldman, and she was as an interesting person as Eisner was, very involved in different topics, dealing with different problems of her time, very productive with regard to the writing. She left once she was no more. And I had another accident, or I was lucky enough to have a tenure track position in the United States, in New York City at that time. And this gave me the opportunity to go to the archives to actually read the unpublished material. And the Institute of Social History in Amsterdam, the International Institute of Social History, has also quite a collection that you can browse online. So I had this vast material about Goldman, and at the beginning I didn't have a plan to write a book at all. I was just interested in the person. And then as a sideline of my academic interest, I began to look deeper into revolutions, particularly the German Revolution that was related to Kurt Eisner, and then also into revolutionary theory. And I was starting to think about a comparative model to compare revolutions, which eventually led me to the Russian Revolution, of course. And this led me back to Goldman, because a lot of texts I had read about the Russian Revolution were written by Goldman. And then I just combined those two different topics I was interested in and thought it would be a nice add to the works that already exist on Goldman, because the Russian episode is part of every biography you can think of her, but it is never really an in-depth study of the intellectual Goldman, who was very much influenced by the Russian Revolution, but in a way that her own perspective on those events changed. And intellectually speaking, she realized that she made a mistake in the past that in a way haunted her. So she tried to readdress, to reframe her image of revolution, although she never lost hope in revolution as such. So she was sure that if there is a better future for humanity it can only be achieved through revolution. So eventually, a lot of lucky accidents, I would say.
So would you say that this focus on Goldman's intellectual trajectory as a result of the Russian Revolution is what distinguishes your book from like the existing literature on Goldman, who as an iconic figure, you know, has already got quite a lot of material written about him?
The approach was not to write a biography, because there are already splendid biographies you can read. You can read Everich and Everich on Sasha and Emma, this double biography. Vivian Gornick has written a biography that is just extraordinary. And then you also had biographies, for example, from a feminist angle, like Candace Falk, Alice Wexler, or Donna Kowal, who just published a book in 2016 on Emma Goldman and public womanhood. So there was no intent for me to write a biography, because there are better biographies than I could ever write. But there was also a very strong focus on Goldman as a kind of proto-feminist of her time. And with regard to free speech, the revolution was always there in a way, but it was never brought to the open. Although I think this experience of the Russian Revolution, the experience of deportation, the experience in Soviet Russia, and then being in exile for a long time, trying to persuade people that the Russian Revolution is good while Bolshevism is bad, was something that determined a large part of Goldman's life since 1917. So almost a little bit more than 20 years of her life were determined by that. And to bring that to the open, to see Goldman more like an intellectual figure who was dealing with the historical events, was the initial attempt of the book. Yet I also wanted to make sure that Goldman is a very diverse personality with a lot of identities that overlap. So that's why I have this introductory chapter on the identities of Emma Goldman, who is, of course, an anarchist who can be understood as an early feminist, who is somebody who's arguing for free sex or the freedom of sexuality for everyone, and who argues always for a better form of society than the one that exists. And it's also interesting that she did that in the United States, which became as repressive as an autocracy against those radicals of foreign origin, and pushed them away, deported them. And of course, in many works, it's always this story, oh, Goldman was heartbroken that she was sent abroad, and therefore she had this melancholic mood and would argue against everything, including the Russian Revolution. Ben Reitman writes a letter to her that she's the anti-mind, she's against everything, and that's why people hate her. And she plays cool in her answer, but this is how she is also perceived. And that one has to be careful not to argue that everything Goldman wrote about the Russian Revolution was just an emotional reply to being deported, because that, in a way, diminishes her argument and also diminishes her standing as an intellectual. And in this case, an intellectual who had eyewitnessed the events in post-revolutionary Russia. So for her, it was like sitting between the stools. She couldn't please the people who wanted to read something great about Russia, or Soviet Russia, to be more precise. And she also couldn't please the post-revolutionaries in Russia. And she was always sitting somewhere in between, because she, as one of the first people in Soviet Russia who witnessed the events, realized and publicly expressed that this revolution was corrupted, that this revolution was at the end. That's one of the questions that is important for all revolutionaries at one point. How do you persuade people to believe in something that just failed? And that was for Goldman really problematic, because the conservative forces around the world were cheering. There is an anarchist that says revolution in Russia is terrible. And the left people, or her own circles, not only the anarchist circles, but also the other left intellectuals in the United States, were against her because they felt that she betrays the Russian Revolution or what it supposedly stands for. And this makes the situation quite problematic. And in the book, I wanted to focus on that particular life in context to the Russian Revolution.
You navigate that relationship really well in the book. You know, you don't lose sight of Emma Goldman, the person, but you're also, you know, you make sure that, you know, to stress that this is also an intellectual journey through Russia as well as a personal one. And just to follow up on that, actually, I wondered if you had any thoughts about why it is that so many works on Goldman focus in on this emotional state or try and explain her attitudes towards Russia through this idea of her melancholy or her homesickness. Two things that kind of came to mind for me. One is perhaps because she's a woman. Reading that letter towards the end of the book, you know, from her former manager, it's a horrible and devastating letter, really, that he sends to her. And as you say, she replies pretty well, I think, in a sort of offhand way. But there's that. And then also, I wonder if it's a broader thing with many anarchist figures, to be honest, that they're often treated in this personal way or emotional way, with some exceptions. You know, someone like Kropotkin is taken quite seriously, but, you know, there are many other figures for whom, you know, the biographies or the works that study are basically these kind of personal journeys, and the intellectual contribution that they make is sometimes kind of overlooked.
Yeah, I think one is just the tradition, because the reports about Goldman of the time after the Russian Revolution were like that. So there is Goldman, who always stressed that the Russian Revolution is so much better than the United States at the moment, or the society that was created by the Russian Revolution is so much better than what exists in the United States. So in a way, there are those anecdotes that just survive, that Goldman is sitting there in her little office in Moscow with an American flag, and she's so sad that she's not in the United States anymore. So one part of this is something that was just repeated in every biography in a way. And in another way, it is very chauvinistic to say that, because it emphasizes that women have not the capacity to be a full intellectual, but they would always refer to their emotions to explain something, which is very bad, because Goldman is not perceived as a full intellectual who has intellectual struggles at that time as well, not only with Bergman, because Bergman says the end will be what we are looking for and the means have to be accepted. And Goldman is very critical to that and said, we don't have to accept the means here, because the revolution is dead, and it has been dead long before. So supporting Lenin and the Bolsheviks at that time doesn't make sense. But that's also something that is not so clear for everybody outside, because Goldman starts criticizing Bolshevism once they leave Soviet Russia in December 1921. The first letters appear in January 1922. And there's always the question, why didn't you do that before? And in some letters she wrote personally, there is this explanation of fear to be one of the anarchists that disappear, that are executed without a trial. Then there is also, where would they go if they are leaving Soviet Russia? They cannot go back to the United States. Other countries that had been anti-anarchist in the past would also not be very happy to greet the two famous anarchists at that time. And the world was in turmoil after World War I as well. So there were a lot of revolutionary attempts in different contexts. So to bring in two active revolutionaries from Soviet Russia would not be the best choice at that time, even if it's in the early 20s already. So I think it is important to make sure that Goldman, on the one hand, of course, was a human being, and the context of her life determines her opinion. But she was also an intellectual who could reflect on the fact that she made a mistake in the past. And this reflection is something, especially the American left, probably never forgave her for that. And some of the traditions describing Goldman as this weak woman that is just melancholic and hates everyone and everything is something that has been transported or kept alive through the years, I would say. There are some works, especially the ones after the early 90s, late 80s, that try to revert that image. But when you talk to people that are just familiar with Goldman, they say, oh, she was deported, and then she was very angry at the world in a way. Of course, in her autobiography, that's also a problem. She is not very critical of herself. So one could get the impression that she was angry for another reason than just an intellectual reflection. But one also has to keep in mind, there are another 10 years in between when Goldman didn't achieve anything with regard to reversed image of the Russian Revolution. So at one point, she was just fed up with everything and wanted to write her version of her own history. And therefore, she just wrote an autobiography that was rather uncritical. But who would not? I mean, considering that people will actually read it, you would not come out with the bad part about your life. And she knew that she had to rely on friends and the income of that autobiography to live for the rest of her life. So that made her also consider the writing a little bit more, I would say. Because if you are in a position where you're financially secure, you write other books than you would do as somebody who's still needing a position of security at one point. You see that in books when you look at intellectual careers. The more security there is, the more critical they might become at one point. And Goldman's story is no different when it comes to that.
Yeah, I think that's a really insightful answer. And there's so much there that I'd like to come back on. But I feel like we've really plunged into the heart of your book at this point. And maybe we need to take a step back, you know, perhaps for the benefit of listeners who maybe aren't so familiar with Goldman's life story. So if you don't mind, could you sketch out Goldman's political activity and life story prior to 1917, which is, of course, this turning point, in, obviously, in the history of the international left and for Goldman personally as well?
Her story is quite emblematic for radicalism in the United States, particularly political radicalism. So she came as an immigrant to the United States from Tsarist Russia at that time, and she was not a radical product that was imported. She was radicalized in the United States. Like many other radicals, I'm currently writing a book on Jewish radicalism in New York City and how the metropolis, the urban environment, and the exploitation in the garment industry, for example, creates radicals in New York City. And she started in Rochester, not in New York City, but she started in a factory as well, and she later recovers that this experience, combined with the Haymarket tragedy, where anarchists were executed without any secure proof that they actually had thrown a bomb. So there was a bomb throwing. Nobody knew who it was, but eventually they brought some anarchists to trial, and some of them were executed. So that made Goldman very furious. Also, the early relationship with Bergman also radicalized her in a way, because he became some kind of a, not a role model, but somebody who motivated Goldman and with whom she could share her thoughts. And then, of course, after Bergman was arrested, she was also active in New York with Johann Most, a German immigrant that was quite charismatic leader in the anarchist circles, although this is quite an oxymoron for anarchism when you talk about leadership, but intellectually she was impressed by Most. And she got into the circles of New York City's anarchism, which means there are so many different forms: individual anarchism, anarcho-syndicalism, and other forms. So it's really hard to distinguish, because also the different immigrant communities had their own interpretations. So we have Italian-American anarchism, Russian-American, Jewish-American. But she was lecturing in three of those milieus. She lectured in German, in Russian, and in English. So she also traversed, in a way, were combined those different anarchist circles, but she never did that full time in the beginning. She was a nurse as well that worked in the Bronx for a long time. She wanted to get a medical degree at one point, but her life circumstances didn't allow for that. She also had a massage parlor for scalp massages for a while. And once she felt secure enough to get out of this life of somebody who has to work to fulfill their dreams, once she had sufficient money, she started to live off anarchism, something she was also criticized for by Voltairine de Cleyre or other anarchists who said, oh, how can you live off the movement? That's selfish. You have to lecture for free. And again, Goldman might have hated that, but she had no other choice. And one has to say that her manager, who would later accuse her so harshly, used that income quite well for hotels and stuff like that. So Goldman was accused of abusing the movement for her own purposes as well, which hurt Goldman, but her love relationship with Reitman at that time was also toxic in a way, so that emphasizes the perspective of the human being. But eventually, when she started publishing Mother Earth in the early 1900s, she moved fully into the anarchist movement to make a living off and for it in a way, because she also financed other publications like Bergman's Blast or little pamphlets. And she was interested in many things. I think if we have to break down her anarchism, the essence of it is freedom in every sense of the word. That means political freedom. That means freedom as a woman, freedom as a human being, sexual freedom, religious freedom. It was not religion as such that was criticized, but more the institutionalization of religion to rule other people. And therefore, if we have to break that down, it is freedom. And this is also related to Goldman's personal life, because she was never really free from financial burdens. She always had to make a hassle to get some income, and therefore could well understand what it meant to not be free in every sense of the word. But due to her many relationships that were not marriage-based, she was criticized by the conservatives. Due to her lectures on sexuality, she was also criticized by religious institutions. And also when she demanded emancipation, she was criticized by male anarchists, because anarchism seemed to be very freedom-oriented, but only in the public sphere and not in the private sphere. So she was somebody who really had to be an anti-mind, to quote this famous letter we talked about, because everything needed to have an antagonist for a betterment in the end. But her personal life was very hard, to say the least. And it is still impressive that she never gave up hope. I think there was one moment where she was close to giving up. That was when Bergman committed suicide in the 1930s. But a few weeks later, she got involved in the Spanish Civil War and had a new task in her life, a new revolution, probably something that would eventually bring the change she was hoping for her whole life. And she also realized that that might have been the last chance for such a change. And then, but not long after, she eventually died. And this is the most tragic thing for such a revolutionary, to die without seeing what actually could be changed. But she also declared in one of the letters that her ideas will be alive when she is long dead. And I think that is important to understand, because Goldman is very often only quoted with, if I cannot dance, it is not my revolution, which is in a way a miscitation, because the original story is a little bit more complex, but you can print it on t-shirts. And I think Goldman would be happy about the status of a celebrity, because people would know her, but she would be angry about being misquoted, because the revolution is not about dancing. It's the freedom to decide to dance that is eventually granted by the revolution that is important. And a revolution is, unfortunately, in most of the cases we know, not peaceful and not something to celebrate. But if successful, it will allow celebration afterwards.
you've publicly shamed me there, Frank, because I have that quote on a tea towel in my house with a picture of Emma Goldman and it's been exposed. But I read the longer quote in the book. It does make a lot more sense.
They keep Emma Goldman alive, but I think Goldman herself would feel quite ashamed that people, all of everything she has written, would quote this on a t-shirt. Because she wrote so many things. Sex has to be pleasure for men and women. Sex has to be free for men and women. There are a lot of things that could be on a t-shirt about Goldman, I'm pretty sure. But they could also put Lenin was a bastard on a t-shirt. She would probably be happier about that. But yeah, it's this, and that's what I mean about the anecdotes. There are a lot of things about Goldman that are based on some anecdotes or oral testimony from some time. And then those stories stick with the people, but that Goldman actually stood for intellectual ideas that are more important than that is very often forgotten. Of course, she published these two books about the Russian Revolution that originally were supposed to be one book. And here the misery story starts already, because her ideas were from the beginning not considered important enough to pay attention, because otherwise if a publisher published only 12 chapters of a book, and then realizes, damn, there were another 12 chapters. That is something that is quite showing that there was not that much attention paid to Goldman. The moment she heard about the events in Russia, there was joy and happiness. The autocratic rule of the Russian Tsar had ended. People were celebrating, especially those who had left Russia before and had found asylum in the United States. Some were deciding to go back to help the revolution go further or to establish the post-revolutionary order. And Goldman was just happy that revolution took place in her own time, that it was considerably successful by bringing the autocratic czar to an end and opening up a chance for left ideas to, in a way, frame the social revolution of the century. So it was not just a political revolution. And what was important for Goldman as well was that it was not like a coup d'etat where other people were trying to get rid of the czar, but the masses of the people went to the streets and on the streets changed the existent political system and were now willing and able to change the social system as well. And the Soviets, so the workers, soldiers, and later peasants councils, were from an anarchist perspective an expression of something like a basic democracy or base-related democracy. So an anarchist in the United States who would just read the first reports about the events would cheer to that, because obviously something they had hoped for 30 years in the United States had happened in Russia. And that was for all who thought about revolutions at that time, Kautsky, for another example, who said it cannot be Russia. It needs to be one of the industrialized countries, and that a revolution should happen in Russia is something that is quite impossible because it is not developed enough. So there was from the beginning an intellectual discussion about the Russian Revolution, its origin, its nature, and where it would go to. And the question about democracy or dictatorship. And this discussion had been opened long before Goldman could actually publish her first work about that. So people were probably also fed up with books about that topic at the time Goldman could join the discussion. And therefore, we also see that change. But Goldman, even when she was still in the United States, coming back from prison before she was deported, was in support of the Bolsheviki because she considered them to be the driving force of the revolution that would eventually bring it to a full social revolution where a stateless society, a free society, and an equal society would eventually be the result of all the fights and the misery of the masses. But when she came to Russia, this joy disappeared immediately. Even when she was deported, she was saying, okay, at least we are going to Russia or Soviet Russia. So we have a chance to do something with our life, even if we are no longer in the United States. And this hope was totally destroyed in Soviet Russia when she witnessed all the things that were going on, that Lenin had turned the revolution into a centralized state, a party regime that was only secured by a secret police and by the terror it would use to control the people.
And in the book, you provide different anarchist responses to the Russian Revolution, and particularly the October Revolution. So seen from afar, seen from the United States, it's possible to conceive of the October Revolution as basically a continuation of the same process that's been opened up by February. One thing that has to be explained is, you know, how anarchists are responding to what is proclaimed to be a Marxist party, like the Bolsheviks apparently taking over. One of the things that has struck me about trying to come to understand anarchist responses to 1917 is that up until the Bolshevik takeover, the main criticism that anarchists have of Marxism is not that it's dictatorial or inherently tending towards dictatorship, even though, you know, that's what Bakunin effectively said in the days of the First International. In the following, like, 40 years or so after the Marx-Bakunin split, because the Marxist parties are entering parliament, because the trade unions are gaining in kind of respectability, particularly in countries like Germany, the principal criticism that anarchists have of Marxists is that it accommodates itself to the capitalist regime, it accommodates itself to progress, to a growing national economy and things like that. So when the Russian Revolution happens in October, they see a different type of Marxism, you know, a Marxism that is voluntarist, that is not just waiting for events to take their inevitable process. So there's also a kind of a sense of affinity with the Bolsheviks in that respect. Is that something that you pick up on in terms of the response of Goldman and Berkman?
Yeah, I think with regard to the aim, they were considering that the Bolsheviks had the same aim as the anarchists. And it would be better to support the Bolsheviks to achieve that aim of a classless society that is based democratically, ruled by, or not ruled at all in this kind of way. So initially the question was, support somebody who represents a different approach to what you also want. So they all wanted a classless society, at least on paper and in October 1917. And the Bolsheviks would do what they had declared to do before. They followed the Marxist doctrine that there had to be a dictatorship of the proletariat. And this was established. And Lenin also was smart enough to give a different image when he said all power to the Soviets. That was something anarchists could attached to intellectually and emotionally, because it felt like there are a lot of anarchist elements of that revolution. Of course, when the new economic policy starts and when there is a Red Army, when there's the suppression of Kronstadt, it is obvious for the last anarchists that this position is not true and that what is established is a centralized state under Bolshevist, which means Lenin's leadership. But in the beginning, there were so many elements there, and Bolshevism seemed to be as something you can accept for the better good, which means a successful revolution. And Bergman had this position longer than Goldman. Goldman was more critical about the means, and she was not as indoctrinated as other anarchists that she said, what are the results good for if the means are bad, if so many people have to die, if so many people are suppressed? So she would rather be an agent of a peaceful revolution, which in a way is also a utopian way to look at revolutions. And other anarchists had the same problem. So there were anarchists who in the first period of the revolution, and even after October 1917, or November to be more precise, were in favor of what happened, because a lot of theoretical discussions were claiming that after an initial revolution, there has to be a second phase, period, step, however you want to call that, that will bring the social revolution as well. And it is always the question, how far are you complying with what is supposed to be achieved by which means? And there were some anarchists who were quite active, who also became militarily active, like Bilchatov, who returned from the United States to Soviet Russia, had functions within the new state. So his anarchism was quite stretched. But when we look at the inner anarchist movement from a more global perspective, we have similar discussions in the anarchist movement. So for the anarchists as a global intellectual force, philosophical, political movement, however you want to define that, the Russian Revolution and its result was hazardous because it drove a wedge into that movement and then it finally collapsed with the result that there was a communist alternative after the Soviet Union was eventually established. And a lot of people went through that same course from admiration to frustration. And Goldman had the advantage that she could actually witness that. So she did not have to rely on reports by others, but was able to say, here, I was there, I spoke the language, I talked to many people, I visited the country, not only the capital, and I have the information. Please trust me, Bolshevism is bad. And then you have people, intellectual left, that say, yeah, that might be the case, but it is better to have this kind of revolution than no revolution at all. Like correspondence with Bertrand Russell, for example. Russell is not stupid. He realizes that the Bolshevists are bad, but he also cannot give in to say the revolution failed, the left failed, and what was created is in no way better than a fascist authoritarian state. Just that the ideology is different. And therefore, this Goldman experience, as we want to call it now, is something a lot of anarchists went through and a lot of people on the left political spectrum went to. And it's like a watershed in those lives where you see that some are extremely heartbroken, some have to reorient their own political standing. Within the communist movement, we have a split as well later. So this whole new situation is at first a question, do you want to have a revolution? Do you want to have a successful revolution? And how much would you accept the means that are necessary to reach that? And then there are different categories. A lot of people look the other way. They say, oh, that's the beginning of the revolutionary process. Russia or Soviet Russia is attacked by international forces of capitalism. So if we now criticize Lenin and the Bolsheviki, we play in the hands of the enemy as such. So the decision when to stop the acceptance of what is happening in Bolshevist Russia is something that is a very personal decision in all of those cases. Some take it early on and are criticized by their own movements. Some take it later on and are then not trustworthy because they change the opinions quite abruptly, at least it looks like that, especially in Goldman's case, where there was no open criticism or no strong open criticism that was perceived in the movement. And then immediately it starts like, oh, now we are out of Russia and now we are enemies of Soviet Russia. So it is quite emblematic, probably not precisely emblematic in the sense that each life has different experiences, but the decisions that are made are similar, the time they are made is different regarding to the individual life.
I think that's another thing that comes out really strongly is that so many people are kind of bound up or they're swept up in this moment. And again, obviously considering as well, this is after 3 years of world war, which is, you know, seen as this cataclysm. As I think there's a quote in the book, the First World War had made very strange bedfellows. But it does, as you say, for Goldman, it turns relatively soon after she arrives in Russia, her view on it. Although she doesn't publish, you know, widely her criticism, that sense of unease with what's going on in Russia is coming out early on, earlier than Berkman. And you refer at one point, and I thought this was a really interesting kind of term, to Goldman's migrant knowledge as being something that really plays into that. And I wondered if you could just expand on this term. It's not one I've heard before, and I think it could apply to quite a lot of people, particularly in the anarchist movement at this time. As you said earlier, many of whom are, you know, have experienced migration and sort of transnational movement. What is meant by this migrant knowledge and how that played into Goldman's intellectual development?
Yeah, it's a new way to see migration as a category for knowledge accumulation as well, and from a knowledge perspective. So Simone Lessig and Sven Steinberg recently published an article on that, where they discuss the opportunities for that category of migrant knowledge. Of course, a political migrant that has lived in a state or in a political environment, he or she is criticizing later, separates this criticism from somebody who doesn't have this experience. So the fact that Goldman and Berkman were migrants, forced in that sense because they were deported, made them also specialists on Soviet Russia because they had witnessed things. They were able to speak the language, which is related to the first migration from Russia to the United States. So they are experts by their life story. And when they left Russia, their works should have had more weight because they were the people who could have the knowledge. And then, of course, other political quarrels played a role that it was not perceived well. But with regard to interviews we have today with specialists, we would also like to talk to somebody about Russia today who has experienced Russia firsthand, who we would always say has a special knowledge to Russia, knows Russian intellectuals as well, and is not only giving us a perspective that is based on stereotypes, hearsaying, and the newspaper. So that's why we also value specialists that actually have this kind of migrant knowledge, this kind of experience. And therefore, Berkman and Goldman were specialists of their time. They also had the problem with regard to the publicity that Berkman, for example, didn't want to publish in capitalist papers. So he would just publish his knowledge for a specific group that was already theoretically divided over what he would have to say. That means addressing a wider public was also not possible in the United States, because in the United States, the anarchists were perceived as a foreign problem. And of course, if they had something to say about Russia, that was especially in the 1920s when the books eventually came out and the United States already had to deal with other problems and were more self-centered with regard to the perspective what happens in the world, especially in the 1920s and 30s are not the most international decades in US history. So therefore, they didn't use the migrant knowledge well. I mean, Goldman tried it when she wrote an article for a more bourgeois, housewife-oriented journal, and then they were surprised that it was not about the beauty of landscape in Russia, but about political issues. And then they said, oh, we cannot publish that in, I think it was The Living Home or something like that. And therefore, they missed the opportunities to spread their migrant knowledge as far as possible or as wide as possible. But that also is related to the fact that as migrants and exiled radicals from the United States, they were only appealing to a specific kind of readership at that time. The conservative American in the Midwest would probably not have been an interest in Emma Goldman's report about Soviet Russia. So here we have the urban context, especially in New York City, maybe some places at the West Coast as well. And you see that from the list of people who actually read Mother Earth. because there was a file that was confiscated by the police when they arrested Gola. There were not that many people who actually read that. And this is technically something that never changed in the United States. So anarchism was not the mass movement people would dream of. It remained a very limited kind of audience. And when you compare Goldman's file with the file of Benjamin Tucker, who had published The Liberty, and there is a file of the people who had gotten the paper, and there were also not more than the people who would actually read Goldman. So therefore, the audience as such was limited, even more so after the First World War, when a lot of anarchists also changed their political standing a bit and would rearrange their own lives according to different political movements or in the same spectrum, but they would rather tend to be socialist or a communist or a mix of both, depending on where they were. So this migrant knowledge is interesting. It makes Goldman's works particularly interesting for us when we look for first-hand accounts of the Russian Revolution by people who had the American experience before, in the sense of the sense of liberty and individual freedom that was supposed to be existent after the revolution was influenced by the American experience as well. So usually the context of a life eventually also creates some kind of thinking, in a sense, that is related to that migrant knowledge. And so far, I think Goldman and Bergman were two specialists at the time who could very well judge how free Soviet Russia was and could then report why it was not as free as the people would assume in other countries. But unfortunately, the audience was no longer there, no longer interested. And the publishers, one has to say, Goldman was always arguing about the publishers, considering her experiences with the publication in two volumes instead of one. The price struggle about her autobiography, she had not a lot of trust in them for some specific reason. That's also interesting. She published something in German as well in the early 1920s that was also published by Der Syndikalist in Berlin. So it was also strictly targeting the anarchist audience that would usually get in contact with those writings. But then in 1922, Germany, there were a lot of books that had been published before. I mean, there was the Trotsky-Kautsky struggle in books. Then there was the Austro-Marxist Bauer, Otto Bauer, had published something on the Russian Revolution. So for Germany, Goldman was quite late. And even for the broader attempt of the American market, it might have been better to have one book by Goldman and Bergman instead of two books based on the same material in a short range of time, which is also like, oh, there's another book, and oh, it's the same story. And yeah, marketing wise, the two had the two are authors, and authors always hope that the next book will be. People will read that. People will get smarter than they were before. And people will just approve that you did something good with your book because you enlightened them in one way or the other. But very often, we are, in a way, chasing the same dream. This never realizes. Because today, it is even more important which publishing house you use. And that was Goldman's evaluation. Like, oh, Knopf is a nice guy. Simon & Schuster has a better marketing. Whom should I take eventually, considering that I want to make a living out of that book? And she spent too much time with that, thinking about it. She should have just brought it out, maybe in a short version, and just to have this enlightening effect. But she was not in the position to do so. I mean, she needed the money, and I fully understand that. And but it's in a way tragic. I mean, there were only two reviewers that realized that this is only half of a book. Like, oh, there's no conclusion, that's fine. And Goldman also complained that the publisher didn't send enough review copies somewhere. something that is, it depends on the publisher, of course, but it's quite different. Like nowadays you have to go to a publisher and ask for a review copy to review it. And similar things happened in the past, obviously. So just missed the audience. I think it was too late. It was probably the wrong publisher. It was not well advertised. So there are multiple of things that come together. And then the people who read it, like Reitman said, if you write such a book, I understand why the Bolsheviki hate you. I mean, if that is the result you get from a friend, you don't want to read the critics, because they are even worse. I mean, even today, you see a few references to the work when you read books about Goldman, but you never actually had some in-depth text analysis. What is she actually writing? And I think that's also important, because those books are essential for those who are interested in revolutions and not only about the dance afterward.
Anecdotally, have came across something that might make you feel a bit less depressed about Emma Goldman's impact with regard to Russia. And that's in the correspondence of José Peyrats, the Spanish anarchist historian, quite famously wrote the history of the CNT and the Spanish Revolution. And he wrote to his friend Germán Gracia about the impact that reading My Disillusionment in Russia by Emma Goldman had on him and his own political development. He, you know, he would go on to write a biography of Goldman himself. And because of the persistence of a mass anarchist movement in Spain, not really in other places, after the mid-1920s, and because of the continued efforts of like the Communist Party to organize itself in Spain against this anarchist rival, having a famous anarchist like Goldman, who had this migrant knowledge and who had written and been translated in terms of her impressions of the Russian Revolution, I think was perhaps more significant than you appear to allow for.
Yeah, I was rather thinking in the long term. Of course, in the anarchist circles at that time, people would read it. Some would like it, some would hate it. That was something she predicted quite clear. But the reading is still important today. If you look at revolutions, and there are a few revolutionary movements around the globe these days, and something that you can always read to prepare for how it would or could continue is Emma Goldman's discussion of what happened to the Russian Revolution over the years. And she said, I don't want to write the history of the revolution. That is up to the historians in later years. I want to give a reflection about what happened to this revolution, so that the ideals of the revolution, in a way, as they were expressed in February 1917, were betrayed by a Bolshevist party that would corrupt this revolution. And before I finished the Goldman manuscript, I had also written a book in German, which is also in open access. So for those who read German, it's well recommended. It's 1917, The Corrupted Revolution, which gives some kind of theoretical reflection that is also, in a way, stimulated by reading Goldman, how this revolutionary process was corrupted, how the statements Lenin had given before the revolution did not match what he actually did. And then, of course, there's always the argument, no revolution is going after the book. So eventually you have to react regards the existent realities. But if the masses of the people are aware that there is this possibility for a corruption, I think if there is a sense of not fear, but to acknowledge that there is this danger, one can be much more prepared to what happens afterwards. And it is particularly in that time when the power vacuum is created after the change. And if this change is not in a way accepted by the masses and is not secured by the masses, then there is always a gap for the establishment of a new regime, if that may be a person, like a personal dictatorship, or a party, is up to the national context. But Goldman realized this gap, and she realized that that was exactly what happened in Russia. So if we look at revolutionary movements or protests that might turn into revolutionary movements, we have to be aware that similarities might appear. And then it's always good for the people who are involved in that revolutionary movement to have this sense of awareness. And I think this comparative perspective, Goldman had also sometimes compared the Russian Revolution to the French Revolution, and she had also some reflections about the Chinese Revolution in her collection in Amsterdam. So she was aware that there were multiple different attempts for revolution before, and similarly, mistakes were made. They were made in different forms, but the regime at the end of a revolutionary cycle, if you want to consider it a cycle, is always there. And I think that is also one of the long-lasting impacts of Goldman's work, is that we better understand those processes as long-term processes. And even if the revolution is successful initially, that doesn't mean it is secure yet. And it needs to be secured against the counter-revolution, but also against the corruption from people that are part of the revolutionary movement.
While we're thinking kind of into the, you know, what can people draw in this kind of work for the present day, I think that's right in terms of that's certainly one thing, you know, you can take from this work and Emma Goldman's reflections of, you know, the dangers of what happens in revolution. But I think one thing I, you know, took from it was a sense of hope. And you said earlier that, you know, despite all of the turmoil in her private life and this horrible experience and this isolation after she and Berkman leave Russia, she'd still maintain the hope. And you say, you know, Emma Goldman was one of the few intellectuals who intended to separate the Russian Revolution from its Bolshevik perversion, and to keep the ideals of the former uncontested and uncorrupted. Because I think that's really important, because I think it would be very easy, many intellectuals at the time, or many on the left at the time, once they'd reached this point of disillusionment, to just throw it all away. You know, like the whole thing is bad. Even the idea of revolution is a bad idea. And I think, you know, there remains these moments. Danny was talking earlier about, you know, February to kind of December 1917 or November, December, you know, just after the Bolsheviks, there's still this hope. And it's crucial to acknowledge that this hope was there, that possibilities were there in the future. I think Chino Miolvo does a very good job of this in his kind of popular account of October. You know, the idea that the possibilities were still there, and that's why people like Goldman, you know, got on board. And I think, you know, as much as the cynic in me sees the kind of the cynical edge of Goldman's experience in her words, but also I think important to keep hold of that hope.
I study revolutions very comparatively, and a 10-step model in book form will be published next year in English, open access as well. Thumbs up. And I'm very frustrated because it's very hard to study that and keep the hope alive. I mean, most of the revolutions we can study historically have failed, either because they didn't achieve anything and were not fully evolving as revolutions, were half-hearted, were stopped by a revolutionary movement that was not fighting for the same purpose, like in Germany, where we have the split between social democracy and ones were rather oriented towards reform, others towards revolution, and eventually they didn't create anything besides a republic, which was great, and it was a republic that was necessary, but it was not a stable construct because it was criticized by the left because the revolution did not go far enough, and the right because the revolution happened at all. So they were thought, in a way, caught between the actors, and that made a lobbying for the result of the revolution very hard. So this revolution was never really accepted as an achievement, as a great achievement, because they had an 8-hour day, women were allowed to vote, and they had a free republican system. So this system was not sufficiently revolutionary in a sense. because there was the backlash afterwards. Very often revolutions end in a dictatorship. That might be a single person, that might be a party, like the Chinese Revolution is also corrupted in a way because we have a dictatorship that uses communist ideology to rule in a one-party state that is everything but communist. So those revolutions are really heartbreaking in the sense there were thousands, millions of people that were trying to bring the revolution to a positive result. And all they got for it was violence and a new form of suppression. When we look at Belarus at the moment, we are in the middle of that process already. The change seems to be on the way, yet there is international intervention. Now the original leaders of the revolutionary movement are no longer there because they're either forced out of the country or they are in prison. So what happens if Lukashenko eventually falls? Will there be a new regime that is Russia-backed with a puppet? Will there be a new regime of one of the revolutionary interest groups? Or will it just be a violent civil war until the military eventually takes it over? So very often you can observe that step by step. When we observe the Arab Spring and the consequences in Egypt, and eventually people were saying, oh, the revolution was a nice idea, but I need an income. And some form of military rule is even more stable than what we had before. So how can you keep hope up in those days? First of all, we have to, because those who rule will not change the world to become a better place, because they rule because of existing inequalities. So if we want to overcome those inequalities, if we want to achieve freedom, we have to believe in a revolution, because that, to me at the moment, I might be proven wrong in 50 years, but I will still be alive and say that I never said something that I said today. But the problem is, if we don't believe in revolution, why would we go on? If we don't believe in a revolution that will eventually declare the climate change our most pressing problem, to solve this problem, we need a revolution because we need a global answer to it. We need to be aware of this danger of corruption of revolutionary processes, like the moral corruption of the process. And therefore, and that is something that not only Goldman emphasized, it was already emphasized by Friedrich Engels when he talked about a revolution. First of all, it has to be a revolution by the masses. It cannot be a coup d'etat by a few, because that will never change the existing social order. It has to be a revolution by the masses. So the problem we have is that we have to persuade the masses that they have to hope for a revolution, which is quite challenging, because if you publish something like that as a pamphlet even, the people who read it are people who already know about the problem. So it's not about you guys, it's not about me, it's not about people who have an interest in anarchism or in revolution in general. They know that. The people who don't have to be persuaded. And Engels hoped that it would only take a few more decades, even when he was almost dead in the early 1890s. He hoped that soon there would be a lot of people who were conscious that revolution is the key to social change. Wasn't the case. Goldman hoped that the masses would understand that they are suppressed by the people who were responsible for the First World War, by the people who would exploit them after the First World War. And there were many global protest movements in the aftermath of the war, but they never achieved a revolutionary movement that was fully supported by the masses. In Belarus, I would say that it is a mass movement, different age range, different jobs, different background, different gender, and so on and so on. So it is a mass movement now. The question is this mass movement able to achieve something? And then we also have to agree, if we live in the European Union, I mean, Brexit is a different story, but for me as a European, the one hand, Europe says, oh, that's totally bad what's going on in Belarus. But we don't talk about Hungary, we don't talk about Poland, because we blend out the problem. So those revolutions have to be understood as movements that are transnational, like the Black Lives Matter movement, like Fridays for Future. And there is a lot of revolutionary potential, but this has to be brought together and it has to be a mass movement, because otherwise, if there is no lobby for this revolutionary change, like in the case of the pipelines through the reservations, those struggles are seen for a week, as long as the media has an interest, and then they're gone because there is no mass lobby for it. So what we have to do, it's what we all work for in a way, is to create an awareness for the necessity of revolution. And thereby, we continue what Goldman wanted to achieve. And we can use her, because we can point to Emma Goldman and say, look, Goldman said that 100 years before. Think about it. Why was there no change? Why is it still like it? Why are there people in sweatshop factories? Probably not in New York City, but in Bangladesh, because we are even more globalized than it used to be in Goldman's days. So this is something we can take from her in a way, to speak in a metaphoric way or in an image. We take the torch from Goldman and pass it on, putting the knowledge we gained from all the revolutionary processes in the past, and also turn it on and see what the next generation or our generation currently makes out of it. So if the question is, should we all be revolutionaries? Yes, we should all be revolutionaries. We should all hope for a large global revolution with all what it will cost and with all the damage it will create. It is also our duty to prevent damage for human beings. That's what we can make out of the knowledge of the past. And we have to prevent a revolution that just ends in another form of elite rule, may they be party elites or, in what very often happens, just capitalist elites. So it's even more actual, I think, in the sense that there is an actuality to her writings about revolution, as there is an actuality with regard to her writings about sexual freedom and emancipation. So we have to simply accept that as a role model in a way, not with regard to her long letters that complain about a lot of things in private, but with regard to the statements we make about the necessity for change, I think it's definitely a role model.
Thanks for listening. You can find links to many of Frank's works in the episode notes, including a link to the book that we discussed here, which will be available to read for free in a couple of months. We'll be sending out a note when it's available, so do stay in touch via our Twitter and Facebook pages, both of which can be found at @abcdannyandjim. If you'd like to get in touch via email, our address is abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com. We're interested in hearing from anyone who'd like to do a mini episode on foreign language works unavailable in English. So go to our feed and see our bite-sized episode 1 for an example of this. Thanks to all of you who've got on board with this podcast so far. 10 episodes in feels like something of a milestone, and we hope to keep doing this as long as people are interested. Do tell your friends, colleagues and comrades about the show. We don't have anything to flog other than more of us talking about history, and we'd like to do that to as many people as possible. This is a hard time for many people all over the world, but hopefully also one of possibility. Our solidarity with those finding things tough and with those struggling to make the world a better place. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra, Gente de Miña Tierra. The logo for the podcast is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo. And the image used for this episode is Emma Goldman, the 31st of December 1919. You can find more details about all of these materials in the episode notes. Love and solidarity. Until next time. Thank you.
Senhor Presidente,